Final recon of the area revealed a village nearby whose only occupants were half a dozen scroungy-looking chickens. One long burst from my borrowed M2 carbine gave us Christmas dinner in the form of three decisively dead birds that we plucked and threw on an open fire. We ate them unseasoned and undercooked. They were very, very raw, in fact, but wonderful to us, and we gobbled them down and huddled closer to the fire, thinking how lucky we were. No sooner had we finished than a recon company jeep and trailer bounced across the field to our positions. Christmas dinner, turkey, cranberry sauce, and all the trimmings had arrived. Only the American Army could do that. Unfortunately, our chicken appetizer had left all of us with roaring gut aches, making the second feast a little hard to swallow, but we wolfed it down anyway, because it was good, because it was there, and because none of us knew if this meal would be the last. The enemy took Seoul just after the New Year. The bridge across the Han had been blown, but a few days later the Chinks got a bridgehead across and we once again headed south in zero-degree weather with our tails between our legs. So much for no more retreats. I began to think about all the general's proclamations concerning this war, that we'd be home before Christmas, that the Chinese would not intervene, that we'd hold here or hold there. All of it was bullshit, and I started to wonder how they could possibly make so many dumb statements when each invariably fell apart when put to the test. Then I thought, well, maybe they just don't know. We never saw a general on the front. We seldom saw a colonel, a lieutenant colonel, or a major either. And at squad level, we only on the rarest occasion saw a captain. So how could the brass know how defeated its army was if they weren't there to see an exhausted guy lie down on the road and just give up? How could they know how cold and ill-equipped we were if they weren't there to see blue, gloveless hands stick to the frozen metal of weapons? How could they know how deep and rugged the terrain was if they never climbed a hill? Still, we kept retreating, exchanging ground for time. We were always cold, always hungry, always tired. We were also filthy. It was too cold to even consider washing, so when we got to Suwon and found ourselves with a few days to rest, we decided to take that abandoned city by storm. As in Seoul, everyone had left Suwon in a great hurry, so we could pretty well help ourselves to whatever we wanted. My section took over a house. We scrounged around and found an old-fashioned Korean bath, one of those stand-up jobs about chest high, with a wooden furnace underneath. We filled the tub, built a roaring fire, and one by one jumped in, each of us skimming the other guy's dirt off the top of the water. I was last. The water was almost black by then, with all kinds of crud floating around, but I didn't care. I might not have gotten clean, but for the first time in weeks, I was warm. Just after we left Suwon, my platoon was ordered to establish a night-blocking position astride a north-south road that paralleled a railroad track. The scout section and rifle squad were set up in a defensive line that ran from the road through a rice paddy and onto a railroad trestle. Our machine gun was set up on the trestle, pointing straight down the tracks, where it could put plunging fire directly in front of the deploying troops and flanking fire on the road 50 yards away. Our platoon leader stayed with the two M24 tanks on the road. Behind him was the 81mm mortar squad. It was late at night. All was quiet. We were locked and cocked and pros at this deadly delaying game by now. I moved between the positions, having whispered conversations with the guys. It was a habit I had, to keep myself awake and make sure the men stayed awake too. I was at the machine gun, which was manned by a stud of a Hawaiian trooper named Sheldon, when we saw the enemy coming. There was at least a company and maybe more behind, four abreast, double-timing quietly down the railroad track. When they were no more than 50 yards from the machine gun, Sheldon let loose a long burst that cut a wide swath into their unsuspecting ranks. A burst of machine gun fire was the signal for the infantry, tanks, and mortars to join in the fray. The scout section and the rifle squad immediately poured fire into the enemy formation. The enemy panicked. They did not fire one round in return. Instead, they broke ranks and hightailed it to the rice paddy, running right into the rifle squad's grazing fire. It was great to see. We were cleaning the clock of an enemy force at least 10 times our size. Like young Rommel did, I thought, in 1914, when he ambushed and destroyed almost a complete British rifle company with a handful of soldiers, simply by using initiative and surprise, two of the key elements in battle. The mortar was plopping in rounds of high explosives right on top of the confused Reds. Meanwhile, our tank's main guns, which were loaded with anti-personnel grapeshot, hadn't fired anything at all. A white star cluster flare popped and hovered over our positions. This was the signal to beat feet in retreat, and we didn't need a second invitation. We scrambled to waiting vehicles and moved quickly to and through the U.S. lines. We'd taken no casualties, but I still couldn't understand why the tank's guns hadn't fired. The enemy had been hurt badly, but not destroyed. If those guns had been employed, we'd have completely wiped them out. The sun was coming up as the platoon pulled into the abandoned Chonon schoolyard that served as the base for the recon company. I went over to our platoon sergeant and asked him why the tanks hadn't been used. He looked away and sort of bowed his head as if he was embarrassed, which was very strange behavior for this rugged, highly decorated warrior. "Better see the lieutenant, young sergeant." "Why didn't the tanks fire?" I asked my regular army platoon leader moments later. "I didn't want to give our positions away," he replied. I couldn't believe it. "Give away your positions? Bullshit!" I cried. Sergeants didn't talk to officers like that, but I didn't care. We'd had the closest thing to a glorious victory that I'd seen since the Chinks stuck their noses into the goddamn war, and now this pissweak lieutenant... "You were just too yellow to do your job," I shouted, and stormed back to my scout section in a rage. I grabbed my pack and my rifle. "I'm leaving this outfit right now," I told my platoon sergeant. "I'm not waiting for orders. I'm going AWOL. I came here to fight, not to play hide-and-seek, and where I come from, officers like you've got here would have been drummed right out of the officers' corps." And with that, I headed for the road.
4. The Wolfhounds. He had a unique trait of courage about him which was kind of amazing to us. I'm not saying there weren't others, too, but Hack just exhibited this day after day, and we were in a pretty tough situation. There was a lot of confusion. We were fighting the Chinese, the North Koreans, and the elements, so it was important to have Hack around to give everyone the spark that was needed to keep going, and add a little humor, too, when we needed that. Sometimes he did things that I would consider crazy, but it always sparked us. It really did. He was a fearless type individual, but I think the reason was he always felt that Lady Luck was riding on his side, and that she always would. Sergeant Major Walter Schroeder, United States Army retired, squad leader, platoon sergeant, platoon leader, G Company, 27th Infantry, Korea, 1950-51. "Any man who's wild enough to go AWOL to fight is just the kind of man we want in our outfit," said Captain John Paul Vann when I stopped at his 8th Ranger camp fresh from my breakout from the 25th Recon Company. The 8th Rangers was a great, spirited unit, recently rebuilt after being decimated the night the Chinese entered the war. After I'd explained my situation, the whole outfit accepted me with open arms. The Rangers were elite troops, forerunners of the Special Forces, Green Berets. Their mission was raids, long reconnaissance patrols, ambushes, and other special jobs that conventional troops were not trained to handle. Their history went back to Rogers Rangers before the Revolutionary War. During World War II, there'd been 6 Ranger battalions whose brave and daring feats are unmatched to this day. Historically, such all-volunteer specially trained units had been misused, tasked either with impossible missions for organizations their size or with palace guard combat duties well beneath their skill and ability. When I arrived at the 8th Ranger camp, the unit was chasing guerrillas behind the main lines. Morale was high, and the guys were spoiling for a good fight. But during the time I was there, nothing much, to my way of thinking anyway, seemed to be happening. I was impatient to get into the thick of it, and as proud as I was to be a ranger, guerrilla hunting was not my idea of infantry combat. Little did I know then the starring roles that guerrilla hunting and Ranger CO John Paul Van would have later in my life. Besides, the word was that the 8th Rangers was going to be broken up soon, and something in me said to move on. So I did, until I saw a sign by the road that proclaimed, Wolfhound White Rear. Well, if that's not a guarantee for a good fight, I don't know what is, I thought, and hightailed it to the battalion CP. The 27th Infantry Wolfhound Regiment was a colorful unit itself. The outfit had gotten its name during its stint fighting communists in Siberia during the Russian Revolution. In Korea, the Wolfhounds were known as the Fire Brigade, because whenever there was trouble, they were sent in to save the day. They weren't a special unit, just a group of guys who thought they were good. So they were good. I'd seen members of the outfit regularly over the last months whenever the 25th Recon had been sent to their portion of the divisional front, and I'd always been knocked out because these guys acted more like pirates on the high seas than as a regular army regiment. To begin with, the Wolfhounds wore their regimental crest on their fatigues like the Medal of Honor. Their spirit was just incredible. They were also totally non-military in terms of what I was accustomed to. They seldom wore steel pots. They modified their gear to make it more functional and simply got rid of things that weighed them down unnecessarily. The long wooden handle of the entrenching tool, for example, was cut off so it wouldn't rub against your leg. Packs were thrown away, and you carried a tramp's roll, which was quickly grounded when you got into a fight. BARs were stripped of bipods and carrying handles, and scabbards were tossed, with the bayonet living permanently at the end of the rifle. Grenades were carried in canteen covers. You could fit in 5. And if you wanted to carry a captured weapon, go for it. This renegade kind of soldiering was not only sanctioned but encouraged by the 27th's regimental commander and fire chief, World War II paratrooper Colonel John Iron Mike Michaelis. Michaelis, who would go on to 4 stars, understood what made men fight. He was known for morale-boosting slogans like, "You're lean, you're mean, you're rough, you're tough, you're professional killers," and pre-battle pep talks like, "You're not here to die for your country. You're here to make those so-and-sos die for theirs." The Wolfhounds' proud combat record showed that they believed him, and they had eagerly adopted their commander's no-nonsense brand of soldiering. I was more than ready to do the same. The 2nd Battalion's XO pointed the way up the road to where the rifle companies were deployed. The first unit I came to was Company G, where I reported in to 1st Sergeant Edwin Rager. "I can always use another sergeant," this giant of a top kick roared, then and there assigning me to 3rd Platoon. Finally, with the assurance that I'd be picked up on the morning report, so I wouldn't be considered AWOL or MIA, I joined my new family. At first, it was not the happiest of unions. I should have realized it wouldn't be easy. It's always a bitch to join a unit, particularly one as tight as the Wolfhounds, as an individual replacement, and for some reason it's even worse when you're an NCO or an officer. You don't know anyone, and no one trusts you until you've proved yourself in battle. You get all the lousy details and only the worst battlefield horror stories. You're just the new guy. You're just fresh meat. And to add insult to injury, though I'd been a squad leader and acting platoon sergeant in Italy and a section leader in the 25th Recon, now in the 3rd of G, I found myself an assistant squad leader. I was damned unhappy with the demotion. I probably had more non-com experience than any of the squad leaders in the platoon, but the fact was that in their eyes, I was untried, and all protests to the contrary fell on deaf ears. I didn't help my cause any that evening soon after my arrival when just at dusk I got caught in a rice paddy right smack in the middle of a blistering chink mortar attack. I started to run but slipped and fell in the paddy. When I finally got back to my foxhole, I discovered that my water-repellent outer trousers were covered with human shit, which the Koreans used for fertilizer. Unsurprisingly, the guy sharing my hole was as unhappy about this as I was. I took the trousers off and made do for the night with the two pairs of long johns and two pairs of OD trousers I had on underneath. Lots of layers were the key to staying warm, I'd learned. Bulky stuff like pile jackets were too heavy and constricted movement. Light clothes were more comfortable and much better for trapping body heat. Then I sacked out until it was my turn to go on guard, leaving my foxhole partner to contend with the lingering aroma of my accident. Guard was a grueling ritual, mainly because everyone was always so tired. Each squad had its own sector, normally four foxholes, each about 4 yards apart, the spacing dependent, as were all things in combat, on the enemy, the terrain, and the weather. Two guys shared a hole and took turns throughout the night searching into the darkness. You'd look until you got tired, then glance at your buddy sacked out at the bottom of the hole. Then you'd look a little longer while you thought, should I wake him now? Has he had enough sleep? Few guys had watches. To own a watch in an infantry squad during that first Korean winter was a luxury beyond imagination. So you spelled each other based on the honor system, and you only asked for relief when it was impossible to keep your eyes open any longer. Then your buddy would ask for a sit rep, SITRPT, or situation report, and that was it. You'd be asleep almost before you zipped up your feather-down fart sack. What's happening? I asked when my foxhole partner woke me for my turn. Not a thing, he replied, and was out like a light. Still inside my sack, I sat in the darkness on the edge of the hole, got my eyeballs unglued, and tried to remember where I was. I was fantasizing about smoking a cigarette, drinking a hot cup of coffee, eating a charcoal black rare steak, bite by delicious bite, and getting a squad of my own, when, to my amazement, I saw a man lying prone to my immediate left rear. I woke up my buddy. There's a goddamn chink almost on top of us. We whispered through our options. We could toss a hand grenade, blast him with a rifle, or crawl out and get him with a knife. We decided on the third alternative, because the guy was right in the middle of our squad position, and rifle fire or a grenade could easily start a firefight among our own guys. The chink wasn't moving, and his back was to us. My buddy covered me while I crawled out of the foxhole with my trusty M1, a 10-inch-long razor-sharp bayonet attached. In a crouched position, I silently slipped up behind the enemy soldier. When I got within sticking distance, I drew back my rifle and thrust it with full force. Branches crackled, and it was over. I'd bayoneted my own frozen-stiff trousers, which I'd earlier hung over a bush behind our foxhole to dry. The next morning, I had to put the shitty things back on again, now with the hole in the ass as well, and for some reason, the fresh meat was the only one in the squad who didn't think it was very funny. The war seemed lost. At best, it was hopelessly confused. I thought wars, at least America's wars, had happy endings, like capturing Berlin and Tokyo. All we were doing was yo-yoing back and forth across the Korean Peninsula. Defeat, then victory, then defeat, and defeat. With G Company 2, we were retreating, shuffling along, heading south, colder, sometimes the temperatures were 20 degrees below zero, and more tired than we'd ever been in our lives. One day a snap thaw had us wading through mud on both sides of a mire that had once been a road. Jeeps and trucks sloshed through it too, each vehicle trying in vain to miss the rut of the vehicle in front so as not to become bogged down. One jeep stalled and would not restart just as our column was passing by. The driver and lieutenant passenger unasked the thing. The lieutenant called for help to push it over the side. But before we could slosh through the quagmire and give him a hand, he whipped out his pistol and aimed it at one of the tires. I figured his daddy must have been an old horse soldier, and this guy was going to follow the cav tradition of shooting his disabled mount. And sure enough, pow, 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 pow. But the last shot missed the tire. It glanced off the rim and boomeranged back to strike the lieutenant right between the eyes. We pushed the jeep and the warm, still body off the road and then returned to our column. Soon the temperature dropped, the road turned to ice, and we just kept heading south. It hadn't meant anything, the lieutenant's death. For openers, what he'd done was dumb. But more than that, we'd become immune. Fighting a war on the ground is like working in a slaughterhouse. At first, the blood, the gore, gets to you. But after a while, you don't see it, you don't smell it, you don't feel it. So, what's another dead body? It's almost as if you don't care. In this case, we just leaned forward, kept walking, and tried to ignore the song in our heads, the one the troops called the Bug Out Blues. So this is the life of the ground pounder, I'd often think. The risks were higher than in the recon company, but life in George was far more harsh. At least in the recon, we frequently rode on the backs of our tanks and thus kept warm. In the infantry, it was just a plodding grind, one foot after the other, until the column stopped and we'd flop down, sound asleep before our heads touched the ground. In the recon, we were seldom hungry because we stashed rations on the tanks. In the infantry, growling bellies were our constant companions. In the infantry, many men lost their will to live. Frequently, guys would just quit, drop out of the moving column and plunk down on the side of the road, sometimes with the Chinese within sight. You'd say, "Come on, buddy, get up, let's go. You're going to be captured." And he'd say, "I don't care. I can't go another step." A day felt like a week, and the more tired an infantryman became, the more he wanted to lighten his load. First to go would be the souvenirs, the captured goodies like SKS rifles, and then his extra ammo. Next would be bulky gear, field coats, pile jackets, and down sleeping bags, even though he knew he'd freeze that night. In the infantry, I found you live for right now. You don't give a damn about tomorrow because you don't even know if there'll be one. Now and then, if we were really lucky, we'd stop in a village and commandeer an abandoned house for 10 or 20 winks. A Korean home had adobe mud floors under which lay an oven, the purpose of which was to provide central heating for the entire house. Of course, American soldiers had no idea how these things worked, and the first time around we built the biggest fire we could and went to sleep shivering and bitching that the gooks didn't know how to do anything right. It turned out, though, that the previous occupants of our temporary abode had the last laugh. Throughout the night, the floors got hotter and hotter, until some of the guys' jackets spontaneously combusted, and the ammo we laid on the floor blew up. Snow never looked so good. On most nights, though, to stave off the cold, we employed old soldiers' tricks from the bleak, frozen days of Valley Forge. One was to stuff hay in a poncho and wrap it tightly around two guys to keep in body heat. Another was to fill your steel pot with hot coals and embrace it all night long, a practice that continued despite the number of tired soldiers who died this way from asphyxiation. Another was to put a slug through your foot. I'd thought about that one, most of us did, but it always seemed too risky. You might blow your foot off, or you might be caught and court-martialed. But one bitterly cold night, when I would have done anything to get out of that place, I came up with the perfect solution. If I emptied most of the powder out of a grenade, I could toss it into my foxhole and blame it on a sneaky Chinaman. Better yet, if I chipped a trench on the side of the foxhole with my bayonet, I could contain the damage to my leg. All I'd have to do would be lay my body in the trench, stick my leg in the hole, toss in the grenade, and bang, a $1 million wound. It was a wonderful idea, somehow a lot better than the one I often saw during a firefight when a guy would stay in his hole and wave his arms or kick his legs like a chorus dancer, hoping to catch a slug and the first boat back to the States. And I spent all night digging away, working on the trench, and thinking how warm I'd be back in Santa Monica, the war vet who got it in the leg. I chipped and chipped away at the frozen ground, completely forgetting about the cold, the time, the fact that I needed some sleep, or that my buddy, who was sleeping behind the hole, may have had enough. Finally, it was ready. I hoisted myself into the trench, prepared the grenade, and dangled my leg in the hole. And I was just about to pull that pin when I saw the most beautiful sight, a sight that every infantryman in Korea dreamed of seeing. It was the sun, slowly rising. It meant the terrible night was over. It meant I could light my fire and be warm again. So I forgot my little trench, and for a long time afterward wondered if I really would have pulled that pin, and for a moment forgot the other thing the sun meant, the beginning of yet another long day, another step south, the never-ending bitter taste of defeat in all our mouths. And then, as if overnight, everything changed. It turned out that despite the fact that I never saw a general on the battlefield, apparently one Lieutenant General Matthew Ridgway had been all over the 8th Army front, assessing the situation and making his plans. "I rode in an open jeep," he would later write in his memoirs, "and would permit no jeep with the top up to operate in the combat zone. Riding in a closed vehicle in a battle area puts a man in the wrong frame of mind. It gives him an enormous sense of warmth, of safety. His mental attitude is that of an ostrich poking his head in the sand. Also, I held to the old-fashioned idea that it helped the spirits of the men to see the old man up there, in the snow and sleet and the mud, sharing the same cold, miserable existence they had to endure. As a consequence, I damn near froze." Nevertheless, Ridgway persevered, with no quarter given. He banned the word retreat from the English language, at least insofar as correspondence could describe our miserable trek to the south. "I'm more interested in your plans for attack," he told a staff officer when the latter offered up those for another withdrawal. He recognized even before we did that the Chinese offensive was running out of steam, and sought to take advantage of it with deep patrols to the north to find out exactly how stretched the enemy was. Operation Wolfhound was the first of these, and the Fire Brigade, under the command of Colonel Michaelis, one of General Ridgway's World War II airborne protégés, was on the attack once more. Two platoons of G Company and elements of the 89th Tank Battalion made up one of the task forces. Named for and commanded by our company commander, Jack Michaely, Task Force Michaely was given the mission of taking Suwon, and on the 16th of January it did just that. The enemy was totally unprepared for the daring daylight assault. George was outside of artillery range, and Captain Michaely, an old horse calf man, approached Suwon in the only way possible, frontally down a road never probed for mines, and fast. My platoon, the 3rd, was not involved in the blitzkrieg operation at all, but when the other guys came back, having killed 150 enemy without a casualty of their own, in high spirits and with stories of Captain Michaely sauntering across the streets of Suwon while enemy machine gun slugs thudded all around him, our morale went sky high. We were ready to take on the world. Meanwhile, I got my squad and immediately set about instilling it with my trust, standards, and beliefs about the way things should be done. I got out a notebook and wrote down each man's name, rank, and serial number, his blood type, weapon number, next of kin, and whatever training and combat experience he had had. I started demanding that rifles be cleaned and that soldiers shape up. If I saw a soldier walking around without his weapon, the next thing he knew he'd be on the deck crawling to it, while I stood by kicking him and telling him with each kick that he was being hit with the slug. Brutal stuff. I'd learned it in basic training when Lieutenant Kramer at the Fort Knox rifle range kicked my arm until I'd positioned it correctly under my weapon. But that's how a guy learns. Besides, better my foot and a mythical slug than an enemy slug and goodbye friendly foot, arm, or life. My guys thought I was crazy, and a prick to boot. They still didn't believe I'd paid my battlefield dues. Little did they know that they were doing the paying in spades, for making me get that sergeant combat feeling all over again. But then came 6 February, part of another reconnaissance in force mission, codenamed Operation Thunderbolt, which turned into a full-scale attack, and I never had a complaint again. In fact, the reaction was the direct opposite. No longer was I the hard-ass sergeant who arrived out of the blue with strange ideas of discipline and training. Now I was just Hack. Hack, the great fighter who'd gotten shot in the head courageously saving lives and inflicting punishment on the enemy. It really was a great relief knowing I would not have to prove myself to anyone anymore. But what I didn't know at the time was that the name I made for myself on 6 February 1951 was one I'd have to live up to for the next 20 years. It seemed ironic that the thing that saved my life on that day was the very thing I hated most in Korea. The cold. The blood kept pumping, but it froze almost as soon as it came out of my head. After the doc patched me up with a Carlisle bandage, I felt like the little drummer boy in a 4th of July parade. I radioed Captain Michaeli and gave him a sit rep. I'd already appointed another NCO to skipper the platoon. Michaeli told me to head for the road behind which Gilchrist's platoon was fighting. He would send a litter jeep there to pick me up. The platoon doc, always worried about his flock, wanted to tag along. I told him I'd make it, policed up one of our dead M1s, and headed off. I kept low and used the rice paddy walls and irrigation ditches for cover. I probably wouldn't have felt it if I'd gotten hit again anyway, because during my run back down the drainage ditch, I'd fallen through the ice and been soaked from the waist down. The water and zero-degree weather had turned my lower torso into a block of ice. My head was spinning and my balls were frozen, and I wasn't sure which worried me more. Then I came upon PFC Charles, the guy I'd earlier tasked to take the two North Korean POWs we'd captured that morning to the old man for interrogation. Charles was sitting in a drainage ditch by the road eating a can of sea rations. At his feet were the prisoners stretched out in the ditch, dead, each from a single bullet in the back of the head. I was outraged. "Why'd you kill them?" "They tried to escape," he said simply, but I didn't believe him. "Besides," he continued, "I wasn't going to risk my ass to get two gooks out of here." There wasn't much I could do. I told him to report back to the platoon. Gilchrist told me later that Charles had received word only days before that his brother had been KIA over in the 2nd Division. "Not too good a choice of an escort, Hack," he'd remark, drawing on his pipe. I continued on. Small arms and machine gun fire was skipping down the road. I gave it all a big miss and kept to my little ditch. I headed south until I met Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Murch, our old pro battalion CO, who was controlling the battle from his tactical CP behind a roadside knoll a few hundred yards from the front. There I was placed on a litter in a medical jeep, and as we bumped down the road, all I could think of was, "Hallelujah, I've got it made. I'm leaving this goddamn place." Or so I thought, because just then the jeep's radio crackled on. "First platoon, George Company, got a serious wound, real bad. Get there fast. He'll be on the side of the road." I couldn't believe it. "Let me out, I'll wait here," I thought, but I was too weak, too tired, and too cold to get the words out. The jeep spun around and headed back up that fire-swept road, past Colonel Murch, right into the jaws of the whole goddamned communist army. We stopped. The medics calmly sauntered out to pick up the other casualty. They took all the time in the world, or so it seemed, while the enemy used the large Red Cross markings on the jeep for target practice. The jeep's canvas sides were being ventilated, the slugs passing above and below my litter. I felt totally helpless and swore that whoever the wounded guy was, I'd hate him for life, which, from the way things were going, was not going to be long. It turned out that he was a buddy through the Hawaiian Mafia connection, a handsome six-footer named Ray Mendez. I almost kept to my word, though, when I found out his critical wound was a slug in the thigh. When he'd been hit, he'd rolled up in a ball. Blood had squirted out of his leg all over the front of his jacket, and someone had concluded he'd taken a hit in the gut. Oblivious to the fight raging on all sides of our thin-skinned ambulance jeep, Mendez became chirpier and chirpier as we headed out of the battle area. He sang the praises of his million-dollar wound and spun dreams about his imminent return to the islands. "Me one big war hero, brah," he said. The regimental collecting station was jammed with casualties. The surgeon who bent over my litter was covered in blood, like a butcher. "We're going to bypass division clearing and send you right to MASH at Suwon," he said. "You're on your way home." The next stop was quick. The MASH was near the runway at Suwon. The doc there wrote on my wound tag, "Emergency Air Evac," which somehow scared me, and before I knew it, I was strapped down to the deck of a C-47. We took off just at dark. "Why don't they close the goddamn door?" I thought. It had to have been open because I'd never been colder. I was shaking like a jackhammer, and I couldn't feel my hands or feet. The flight nurse stayed right with me, another ominous sign. She piled on blanket after blanket with no effect. Just as I was reaching the point where I didn't know if I could take it anymore, we landed in Pusan, and it was another world. Paradise, in fact. A heated ambulance was waiting. And as they loaded me in, I felt like that old boll weevil who lived in a red-hot fire. Mighty warm, but nice. I'd found a home. I fell asleep and didn't wake again until I was being winched aboard the hospital ship USS Haven in Pusan Harbor. I opened my eyes, and everything was white, clean, and oh so warm. Medics were starched. The nurses all looked like Doris Day. I was stripped, placed in crisp white sheets with soft blue blankets. I was safe and suddenly starving. A medic came to the immediate rescue with a delicious hot meal. I wolfed it down just in time for the next wonder of wonders, a beautiful young nurse in a tight little white outfit who came to clean me up. Why didn't I join the Navy, I thought. Except for my bath in the Korean tub, I hadn't washed in more than 2 months. I was caked with dried blood, Korean mud, and God only knew what else. And each time the nurse scraped off one filthy layer, she'd have to change the sheets and start again. It took 4 sheet changes, with no help from me because, as a head wound, I wasn't allowed to move at all. Next, the poor girl had to shave off my ratty beard. Bad hygiene and ingrown hairs had covered my face with boil-like pimples. It was too terrible to be funny, watching the nurse bobbing and weaving all over the place to avoid the flying debris every time the razor hit one of the anti-personnel mines buried in my cheeks. The next few days were a haze. Sleep, really hard sleep. People standing over me, having whispered consultations. Blood, IV, X-ray after X-ray. Doctors probing, asking questions. How many fingers do you see? I slowly regained my strength. Somebody commandeered my Waltham watch. I never saw it again. The sleep was good. I caught up on months of it lost. But then I started getting restless. The ward, though spotlessly clean and staffed with talented, dedicated pros, was an extremely depressing place. We were all head wounds, most either terminal or vegetable cases. It was amazing that many young boys, all of them, were still sucking in air. One guy had tubes running out of everywhere. He'd caught a slug between the eyes. I wanted out. I'd had my little vacation. I told the docs, I'm ready to return to my platoon. There's nothing wrong with me. The docs probably thought that the bullet had done some pretty serious damage to my brain. Nobody wanted to go back to the front. They didn't realize that the guys in the 3rd platoon were my brothers, my family, and I loved them. I'd only been with them 3 weeks, it was true, but in combat, that's a lifetime, and I didn't want to leave them out there alone. If by being there I could help keep them alive, keep them out of a head wound ward. I want to go back, I kept telling them. Sure, they'd say, giving one another those he's a little screwy looks, and soon they sent me to Osaka General Hospital in Japan. The regiment had been based in Osaka before Korea. The city was the wolfhound's lair, so we were looked after wonderfully, not only by the medical staff, but by the distaff side of the regiment as well. The wives visited us often, brought little presents, helped us write letters home, and gently reintroduced us to the civilized world. A wife would find out through the grapevine that a guy from her husband's company was hospitalized, and she would rush to his bedside. "How is my husband, Sergeant Rager?" she might ask. "Mean as ever," you would say. But sometimes the replies were not so glib, especially if a few days earlier you had seen the husband cut in two. Looking into the anxious faces of warrior wives, I thought that only a foolish woman would allow her man to earn his living as a moving target. After a lot more tests, the docs concluded that I was okay. There was no brain damage. The wound had actually been superficial. The bullet had passed under the skin on the left side of my head, grazed along the top of my skull, and then punctured through the skin again in the back. All it had left me with were 2 buzzing ears, a neat V branded on the back of my head where the slug had come out, and a hankering to get out of the hospital and on with the promised convalescence leave. A G-Company guy told me he had seen Mendez up in the leg ward. The bullet had done a job on him. He was still a bed patient. "Your little scratch almost cost me my life," I joked with him. "If I'd been the doc, I would have left you there with a band-aid." Mendez laughed as only a Hawaiian can laugh. "It Hawaiian mafia, brah, got me out. They fake whole thing. Now I go home. May pow, man." "I'm finished," he said, with more belly laughs. The Hawaiian mafia was a term we had that referred to the large number of Hawaiians among the wolfhound ranks. The 27th had spent years on Oahu before World War II. Even though the regiment had not been back to the islands for almost a decade, the wolfhound history was such that Hawaiians coming through the replacement pipeline fought, lied, and cheated to get into the outfit. Consequently, most of the companies had tons of islanders. Individually and as a group, they were the most stalwart and loving of friends, and they stuck together like glue. They were also the wildest, bravest, and most undisciplined fighters on the block. They had an almost obsessive drive to prove themselves on the battlefield, a drive I always thought came from their older brothers who'd made up the fierce 442nd Regimental Combat Team during World War II. Of course, the 442nd, the most highly decorated regiment in that war, was a hard act to follow, and part of the charm of this generation was that they never stopped trying. "Go for broke," the 442nd motto was the favorite expression among them, with act after act of sheer guts. Mendez and I caught up on where George was, what lumps the company had taken, and all other bits of information we could garner from new arrivals. It turned out that on 6 February we had taken on a reinforced North Korean regiment and really torn its ass. 170 enemy bodies were found on position, with additional killed and wounded estimated at 500 men. Before being ordered to withdraw by Battalion CO Colonel Murch, we'd captured 5 anti-tank weapons, 2 120mm mortars, and 9 machine guns. We'd knocked out 3 artillery pieces, too, and come within 200 yards of overrunning the enemy unit's regimental CP. The next day, 2nd Battalion had continued the attack, but the North Koreans had met their match with Gallant George and bugged out to prevent an encore performance. 3rd Platoon, despite the mauling we'd taken in the first moments of battle, had hung on tenaciously. We only now found out that we'd been operating in an area intended for an entire company. Fox, which had gotten hung up with a lot of enemy behind us, and whom George's Tank Infantry Task Force had hauled ass and bypassed. We heard that Captain Mikely had been shot in the ass but kept on fighting, that Lieutenant Land had $3,000 of poker winnings in his pocket when he died, but that the guys had left it on him even though they knew it'd be knocked off at grave registration, and that 1st Platoon was putting me in for a medal, for saving their ass after I was hit. Well, that was news to me. I hadn't done anything of the sort, or if I did, I didn't, nor would I ever remember it. Still, word of this and the rest of the stuff that happened on 6 February started flashing around Osaka General, though all of it exaggerated to hell and back, and suddenly I found I was big man in the hospital. An ardent admirer came in the shape of an army nurse. Her shape, to be exact, was that of a tackle for the Rams, and she would look at me adoringly as she gave me my shots. I was getting penicillin every 4 hours in the ass. To this nurse's credit, she was so magic with that dreaded needle that I seldom felt a thing. But I was into cheerleaders, not tackles, and the unhappy day came when she started suggesting that we take leave together. At first I tried the soft line. Love to, but sergeants can't socialize with officers. This tack got me nowhere. If anything, it increased her passion for a little hard scrimmage at some idyllic Japanese hideaway. Finally, I had no other recourse but to lay it on the line. There are only 2 things in life that interest me, I blurted out. One is sex, and the other is adventure, and you don't offer either. I was too young to know about the woman scorned bit, but until I escaped her a week later, she managed to find needles with square points, which she drilled into my aching cheeks with a vengeance. On the first day of leave, I met a lovely Japanese girl. She was probably a pro. Some were, some weren't, but it didn't matter. At the end of your leave, you always gave your little girl son whatever money you had left anyway. She'd made you forget the war for a while, and that was worth something. So maybe she wasn't a pro. In any event, she was gentle and kind and fun, and we had a glorious, roaring 2-week party together. And that was all you wanted on leave, convalescence or other. To live as high as you could, which meant good food, good women, lots of booze, and staying blasted all the time. To spend all your money and have a lot of fun and try not to count the days before you had to go back. The Han had been crossed and Seoul retaken. George Company was once again north of the city when I returned to my unit in mid-March. The company was tired. It had seen continuous hard combat since I'd been evacuated. But it had done a great job throughout, and was even in for a presidential unit citation for the action on 6 February. I took over my old squad. Things hadn't changed that much. Every day was still a grind, with one steep hill following the next. But there was one big difference. Now it was the enemy who were on the run. The Yo-Yo was headed back up the peninsula. Our spirits were higher than ever before, like Montgomery at El Alamein, who'd given the Allied forces their first victory in 3 years of war and heralded the turning point of World War II. Ridgway had completely turned his defeated army around. It was undoubtedly the most significant leadership achievement in modern military history. We were miraculously well-equipped with winter gear and weapons. The supply system was belching out all kinds of good things. TAC air and outgoing artillery were plentiful. No matter how hard the enemy fought, they couldn't hold us back. We had 2 BARs per squad and 2 light machine guns, LMGs, in the platoon. The Browning automatic rifle was the best infantry weapon in Korea. Rugged and reliable, it seldom jammed, and a good gunner could mow the grass with its blistering and sustained rate of fire. We had cold weather shoe packs, too, and hot chow at least once a day. All things considered, we couldn't have asked for much more. And it really wasn't until 30 March when Company G was tasked to seize and hold a high, craggy hill designated Objective Logan that the good times seemed to come to a screeching halt. Korea was a bitch of a place to fight, because you weren't just fighting Chinamen and North Koreans. You also fought the hills themselves. Most were steep and razor-backed. Many were solid rock, which meant an attacking force had to contend not only with enemy fire raining down from above, but also with rock fragments. As bad news as the flying steel. Objective Logan was one rocky hill. It resembled the top of the Rock of Gibraltar, and was so steep that only one platoon could attack on the company front at a time. After the lead platoon secured a ridgeline about 500 yards from the objective and established a base of fire, 3rd Platoon, originally tasked as the reserve element, passed through and became the assault force. We moved along a ridge, concealed by low-lying clouds, but as the sky opened up, so did the enemy, with 75mm pack howitzers, 60mm and 82mm mortars, and wall-to-wall automatic weapons fire. We had casualties from the first shot, including our new medic, a black sergeant named Brown, who took a slug just below the heart while pulling a wounded kid to safety. We were pinned down, and would have remained so forever but for Phil Gilchrist, who'd recently taken over as 3rd Platoon leader. Gilchrist told us to move out, and we moved out, with him at the point, up Objective Logan with weapons blazing. On top of the hill, the Chinese were well dug in and fighting a tenacious and determined defense. They were throwing the world at us, and for every inch of ground we gained, they extracted a terrible price. It was tough slugging, not unlike the fighting in Italy in 1944-45, the same sort of determined enemy, the same rough, difficult terrain. The Chinks flung grenades at us in barrages of 3 and 4 by wringing the pins around their fingers and throwing a handful at a time. You could see their hands rising over the crest of the hill, bedecked with grenades, which, an instant later, were hurtling toward us. The grenades, bullets, shrapnel, and flying rock fragments took their toll. By the time we reached the top of the hill, only 7 effective fighters remained in the platoon. Everyone else was badly wounded or killed. We etched out a little finger hold by stacking up stones around shell craters. It was still broad daylight. We crested the hill and now looked down on the reverse slope to see the Chinese leaders below getting their men together for a counterattack. U.S. artillery and mortar fire were adjusted through the company radio net. The stuff was popping in so close it was amazing we had no friendly fire casualties. I'd recently taken over the weapons squad. Now I placed our one remaining light machine gun in a 155mm artillery crater, and for a while, Thacker and Wells' blistering, effective fire kept the enemy at bay. But it was still hot. Very hot. The Chinese concentrated all their fire on our little redoubt. Mortars, artillery, and small arms thundered around us. One round landed so close that it knocked over our LMG and filled the hole with fragments. Amazingly, none of us was hit. A 6-inch-long jagged shard of shrapnel landed an inch from my knee. So close, and yet so far from a million-dollar wound. Without thinking, I picked it up to show Thacker and Wells, meanwhile burning the hell out of my hand on the red-hot steel. We stayed low in our crater. Even looking over the brim was a guarantee to be blown away, and for a while had to go blind, returning fire by holding our rifles over our heads and pointing downhill. We were so low on grenades that Lieutenant Gilchrist ordered that we get his permission to throw one. I was down to my last when gut feeling told me it was time to unlimber it, right in front of our position. I motioned for Gilchrist to come over, indicating that we were not alone. I requested permission to pull the pin on the frag. He gave it. I was lying on my back with my head pointed toward the attackers. When I pulled the pin, I spent a lazy second or so setting the grenade on the crater's edge, which didn't make Gilchrist, still lying beside me, too happy. Then I gave it a little flick with my fingers. It slowly tumbled down and exploded. Wham! The hole shook, debris rained down, and then the air was filled with gently floating feathers. A down-jacketed Chinaman had gotten what he was going to give us, except gut feeling had told me to get there first. We were quickly running out of ammo. Thacker had no more than a belt and a half for the machine gun, and our rifles were down to a couple of M1 clips. Strict fire discipline became the rule. We couldn't afford to waste one round. We policed up a case of Chinese potato masher grenades. They were probably World War I German Army vintage and about as effective as cherry bombs, but they made a lot of noise, and at least they were something. Funny how a few hours before we'd been a rifle platoon loaded for bear, and now we were on our ass, hurling firecrackers and not making a dent. As we broke up the last belt of LMG ammo and distributed it for the M1s and BARs, Gilchrist told us that a squad from Sergeant Reeves's 2nd platoon had volunteered to join us on the hill. What a great sight it was, moments later, to see their lead element coming up behind us. "Hello, brah," said their point man, Aguda, as his buddies ran past, tossing us bandoliers of M1 ammo, grenades, and several boxes of machine gun ammunition. "Big fight here, huh?" James Aguda was one of my friends from the Hawaiian Mafia. He'd just returned to his platoon a few days before, after having been wounded during a previous operation. When I'd first seen him, after he'd gotten back, I'd noticed he was not wearing shoe packs. "Get rid of those leather boots," I told him. "You Hawaiian Buddha heads have enough trouble with the cold, no sense asking for frostbite." I'd given him a pretty hard time, intentionally, because I was trying to find out how much his wound had affected him. Sometimes a man would come back from the hospital and say, "Yeah, Sarge, I'm cool, only a scratch," and the next thing you knew, he'd crack up. But Aguda had taken everything I dished out, and finally I said, "Okay, fine, but you better get yourself some shoe packs." Aguda had just shrugged and said, "I'm not going to be around here long enough to need them." I dismissed the comment. Such fatalistic statements were par for the course, especially before a big fight. I hadn't thought any more about it, nor did I now, on the hill. All I thought was that help had arrived. More ammo, more rifles, the staying power we needed to hold our objective. Now we just needed a little time. Aguda, casually sauntering past with his BAR, gave us that. The crazy bastard stood up. He didn't go prone like the rest of us. He just walked to the forward slope and started mowing down the attacking Chinese ranks like John Wayne in the sands of Iwo Jima. His BAR was singing as he fired magazine after magazine, and the whole time he was screaming to the Chinese, "Come on, you motherfuckers, come and get me!" I yelled, "Get down! For Christ's sake, Aguda, get down!" But he just kept firing and reloading, firing and reloading. The perfect killing machine. Slugs were snapping all around him. I knew he was going to be killed. Then I could see he was getting it. I could see it. In the leg, in the arm, then two more in the legs. But he just kept shooting and screaming, and I kept yelling for him to get down. Finally, he took one in the chest. It spun him around, and he dropped. KIA. Aguda's action, and similar actions from the other brave volunteers of 2nd Platoon, turned the tide of the fight. They bought us time at perhaps the most critical phase of the battle, time in which the men of 1st and 4th Platoons could get into position and start putting down the effective fire that broke the back of the Chinese counterattack. But the strange thing about Aguda was that he really had known he was going to be killed. It wasn't just his shoe pack comment. After the battle, a poem he'd written was found among his personal possessions, predicting he would die in battle on a cold, windswept hill. I guess he knew his number was about to come up, and he just decided to go out fighting. The Chinese had broken off their attack, and we had time to consolidate our defenses and evacuate our casualties. An ad hoc platoon aid station had been set up in a rocky outcrop near the crest of the hill. At one point in the battle, it had been crammed with 42 casualties, all of whom were cared for by an amazing infantryman who, armed with knowledge gleaned from a YMCA first aid course, had taken Sergeant Brown's aid bag at gunpoint when the severely wounded medic insisted he could still do his job. We couldn't dig. The hill was solid rock. So we modified chink bunkers, stacked rocks in front of our fighting positions, and hunkered down as best we could. The position was still hot, with plenty of incoming mortar and small arms fire. Our platoon, which was now less than a squad, drew most of it. Thacker's machine gun had been the focal point of the complete battle so far, and we still occupied the high ground in the company center. I was looking for a better machine gun position when the enemy launched another attack. I hopped into the nearest hole, a large Chinese foxhole that had probably been a platoon CP. Now its sole occupant was one dead Chinaman curled up in the bottom. I lay there with him, and whenever there was a lull in the firing, I'd pop up, fire 8 rounds, and go back down to reload and wait until I could jump up again. It was kind of like playing human jack-in-the-box, and during one of these routines I caught a slug. Oh, shit, I thought. Not again, not in the head. My helmet, which I had on backwards, was ripped off my head and I was propelled to the bottom of the hole. If someone took a baseball bat and swung it at you, at your arm, your leg, or your head, with all his might, that's what getting hit with the bullet feels like. Bam! And then you don't feel anything for about 20 or 30 minutes because of the trauma caused by the speed of the projectile. Only after about half an hour does it really begin to hurt. So when I got it this time, all I knew was it felt just as it had on 6 February. My head was spinning. I slowly reached up and touched my forehead, and then I looked at my hand. No blood. I found my steel pot. It looked as if it had been neatly parted with an axe. The bullet had struck the helmet between the bottom lip of the steel and the liner, but because the back of a steel pot is reasonably oblique, the bullet had skipped along between the liner and the steel before coming out the top. If I hadn't been wearing the thing backwards, a habit I'd picked up from my dear friend in the weapons squad, machine gunner Jerry Boyd, I would have been as dead as the chink who was sharing my hole. The incident took the fire out of me for a bit. Ears ringing and in a daze, I was stuck in the hole and didn't know how long I'd be there. I decided to get to know my Chinese companion a little better. I looked through his pockets and found a wallet full of Chinese money and some pictures of his family. The pictures stung me inside. This dead chink had been a real person. I didn't want him in my hole anymore. I rolled his body up the side with my feet. I got him to the top and was about to tip him out when a Chinese machine gun hosed him down and blew off his head. This scared the hell out of me and I dropped him. Now I was sharing my hole with the headless Chinaman whom I liked less with every passing second. It took a dozen tries before I finally rolled him out. Dusk brought a lull to the fighting, but it brought nothing else. No food, no water, no resupply of ammo. The word was that the Korean Chogi Party, our human resupply chain, had gotten lost. Chogi was our nickname for the Korean laborers who worked for the Eighth Army. In Korean, Chogi means over there, as in put it over there. We were so thirsty, all we wanted was water. We'd been in constant hot contact for hours, using up a lot of adrenaline, generating a lot of fear, and fear dries you out. One of the guys found a knocked-out Chinese water-cooled heavy machine gun. We drained the stagnant, filthy water into a steel pot and filtered it through a piece of dirty cloth. It was still oily when we drank it, but to us, it tasted beautiful, like a nice cold beer on a stinking hot day. When you're fighting, you're scared, and it's such an all-pervasive sort of fear that you can't even pinpoint what the feeling is. It's a gnawing, a churning in the gut. You become so afraid that it's as if you're not afraid at all. And that's what bravery is. It's not fearlessness. It's the ability to get off your ass and charge even when your mouth is dry, your gut is tight.